So panelists, please head up to the front of the room. Everybody else, take your seats.
Oh, good grief.
Okay, everyone, we're ready to start our second panel. If you could take your seats. Our second panel is called Transportation Revolution, Let's Get Moving. And the facilitator is Heather Goldstone, host of Living Lab WCAI.
Hi, everybody. I'm really glad to be here, and please excuse me with my water and my tea and stuff. You can probably hear from my voice. I'm in a similar boat with Dylan. Didn't get laid low for 4 days, but definitely have a head cold thing going on. So welcome to the planes, trains, and automobiles part of today's program. You guys may have seen this morning in the New York Times an article about transportation emissions in the nation's largest cities and suburban areas, the upshot of which is transportation emissions are not holding steady, they're not decreasing, they're actually increasing, and they're not only increasing overall, they are increasing per capita. So we're going in the wrong direction when it comes to transportation emissions. And I feel like this is something that we can all really relate to, and certainly I could relate to getting here this morning. I have the CCRTA C-Line route goes right past the end of my street, about 10 houses away from me. And yesterday I was thinking, you know, maybe I can just hop on the bus. I'm actually going from here straight up to Boston to the 70th annual celebration of the Massachusetts State Science and Engineering Fair this evening. And I was like, okay, I could just hop on CCRTA, take the bus over to Hyannis to the conference, then hop on another bus straight up to Boston, all good. Only problem is the bus doesn't actually come here, and I got to tell you, the combination of this attire and the weather outside made biking the distance from the bus station to here not very appealing, and so I ended up coming one person in one car to this conference today to talk about transportation emissions, right? An example of exactly the problem that we need to tackle and that we're here to talk about today. And I wanted to relay just one other, I want to get to our panelists, not me. But one other experience from my personal life from the past year or so that I think is also emblematic of some of the challenges we face. I have a family of five. We have a minivan, and it's a pretty indispensable part of our lives for getting around, getting kids to soccer games and sleepovers and all of those sorts of things, and we would love to go electric. There's one electric minivan on the market, right? And that's only about a year or two old. It's Chrysler Pacifica. Honda's been promising one for, at least to my knowledge, 3 or 4 years, and it still hasn't showed up. And earlier this fall, we said, right, we're going to get serious about this, and we're going to do this before those state incentives that we heard about in the last panel actually expire. Let's go test drive one. We can't test drive one. If you guys know where we can test drive one in southeastern Massachusetts, please tell me, because the places that we've contacted say you can order one. But we don't have them on the lot. You can't come test drive one, right? So even if you're motivated, it can be really hard to reduce your personal transportation emissions. And so that, I think, is, for me, that's the kind of the framing coming into today. We have a lot of work to do, but I like to think that often our greatest challenges are often also where we have the greatest opportunities to make improvement. And so hoping to hear from our panelists today a lot of concrete ideas about how we actually can get moving toward net zero in the transportation arena. So to start with, by way of introduction, rather than just the exact same question for all of you, I do have, but kind of a general opening question. And Stephen Tupper, I wanted to start with you. You guys have bios and stuff. I'm not a fan of reading big bios, but you have bios in front of you. But as a transportation program manager with the Cape Cod Commission, working to have multimodal transportation on the Cape, what would, in your mind, a low-carbon or zero-carbon multimodal transportation system for the Cape look like? And what are we doing to get there?
Well, thank you for starting with an easy question. So I appreciate that.
In 3 minutes or less.
So simply put, there's no single answer to that large challenge of going towards a net zero vision for the Cape. But at the Cape Cod Commission, we're trying to tackle that on a number of levels. So starting most recently with the updated regional transportation plan, updated earlier this year, that's really identifying the different pathways towards that ultimate goal. So it starts with thinking about your personal transportation choices. Certainly, the single person driving in a fossil fuel vehicle to get here is the problem. So we explore all options to look at that. We look at carpooling, trying to get people into more people into each vehicle. Certainly, transit is a big part of the solution, so something we work closely with Tom and his group over at the RTA on, looking at that. And then certainly electrification of the transportation system is provides some of the biggest promise in the near term in terms of shifting our overall carbon footprint of the transportation system. So we're looking at ways to facilitate that on the regional level, although a lot of the action will happen both at the state level in terms of policy and local in terms of implementation. We recognize that our region is a bit different than the others in many different ways, so a lot of our efforts are trying to make sure that the municipalities have the tools to implement on the local level. And then finally, not to lose track of some of the things that we decades, centuries ago, did much better than we do today, and that's thinking about all the users of the roadway. So the roads you see out there are largely built for cars. There are other ways to get around, so certainly thinking about transit and also bicycle and pedestrian access. A lot of our activity is trying to build a street that works for everyone. So it's not to say that someone's going to be able to walk and bicycle for all their trips. That's unreasonable. But 80% of the trips that people take are less than 3 miles, so that certainly gives you the opportunity to take those other modes. And more so, if you can build a system that works for those non-motorists, it works as a network. So one of the biggest barriers to, for example, using transit is actually getting to the transit service. So you have to be able to walk to the bus stop to get to the transit destination. So really trying to think about those linked trips and trying at the local level to deal with some of those gaps to really give options to each individual to make better choices in the long run is really how we're trying to tackle this.
Thank you. Larry, next to you. From your position, the Green Energy Consumers Alliance, really focusing on giving buyers more power to help shift how we're getting energy, how we're getting around. And you shared with the group prior to this panel that your vision for reducing emissions 80 to 100% by 2050 means reducing emissions by 2 to 3% per year. That's at least 1% every 6 months, starting yesterday. So, where do electric vehicles fit into that? How much of a dent could electric vehicles make in reducing emissions at that kind of rate?
So I think everyone's aware, I hope everyone's aware how clean the grid has gotten in the last few years as a result of all kinds of policies, namely the Renewable Portfolio Standard. And so what's happened, as you pointed out earlier, was transportation emissions have surpassed electricity generation, so this opportunity is huge. And so our organization is very much in favor of electrifying any form of transportation right now. And that goes beyond passenger cars to ferries, to airplanes very soon, and so on. And so we need to do that as rapidly as we can. If we were having this discussion 5 years ago, and so there's a slide from Oslo, Norway, that shows, which is one of the world's leaders in electric transportation, and they're not doing just passenger cars, they're doing it all. So that's what I think we need to look at here on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. And so if we were doing this 5 years ago, I don't think I could have said to you with a straight face that every passenger car ought to be electric today and every bus ought to be electric today. I'm here to say that that's what we should be doing right now. And that so if you want to get on the trajectory to 80% or 100% by 2050, that also means 3% of our motor vehicle emissions have to go down every year, which means turning over our fleet of cars and buses and trucks every year. So That means making decisions personally, using state incentives to get it done, as well as, you know, I'm glad to see the transit authorities here as well. So I believe that's achievable. We are way behind, though, in Massachusetts, and we can go into that in a little more depth later.
Absolutely. I don't know if it made it into your programs, but we have one replacement on the panel. Angie Grant was unable to make it over from the Vineyard due to the weather. And so instead today we have with us Stephen Russell. He's the Alternative Transportation Program Coordinator and Clean Cities Coordinator for Massachusetts. Stephen, where does the state factor into this process of turning over fleets and creating the infrastructure necessary to really electrify the transportation system?
Well, it was about 5 years ago that we moved into, you know, we had a state commission that sat down and said, how can we, you know, encourage people to get into electric vehicles? Because the governor at the time signed an MOU with seven other states that said, we want 3 million cars by 2035 on the road in our states. And that equated to 300,000 for the state of Massachusetts. So we sat down and said, what can we do? What are some of the things we can do? We need to educate dealers. We needed to get consumers involved. And, oh, by the way, we should have a rebate. So at that point, our commissioner, in his infinite wisdom, said, we're going to peel off some of the REGI funds for electric transportation. We started the EV rebate. Since then, unfortunately, the REGI funds have kind of shrunk a little, and the interest in electric cars has grown. So we spent $35 million over the last 5 years rebating 14,000 vehicles. And it was a great way. 80% of the people who received the rebate said it was a very important factor in getting their electric car. At the same time, we're one of the few states across the nation that dealers just have the cars available, unfortunately not the Pacifica. And if you had come to our event in Hyannis, you could have driven one because we had one there. So you missed out. So
I think I was driving kids to soccer games that day.
But I think from a policy standpoint, we also studied the state fleet. We have 8,000 vehicles in the state fleet, of which we determined about 3,000 can be shifted over to electric. We're slowly getting there, but I think we would love to hear from the governor and say, hey, we will electrify our state fleet within so many years. Other governors are starting to do that. So policy-wise, we're really making a dent. I think Angie on the Cape has a great story to tell. You know, she has 435-foot buses, and she has 260-foot buses, and they're electric. And she has saved 44% of her fuel costs and reduced her GHG by over 84%. So I think if folks in the transportation sector could look at that and take a serious look, that she has proven that it can work. And I think, you know, the demand charges that she ran into when she first started really killed her on the electric side, but she since has developed and going to put in a battery for storage, and that will go away. And the next level that she's going to get into, which is very, very beneficial to transit, is she's going to do inductive charging, which means that when that bus sits on Church Street for about 10 minutes, it's going to get electricity from the ground. It's going to be an inductive charger, so she doesn't have to plug in the bus. So she can make her 300,000 miles a day, something, 300 miles a day. It was unbelievable. But she has... she has proven that it can work. We also, I think you should take a hard look at your school buses in your communities. I think we did a pilot. Massachusetts funded $1 million worth of 3 electric school buses in Amherst, Concord, and Cambridge. And they're running very well, and it's a great way to get diesel emissions away from the children. So I think those kind of policy decisions, we did that on purpose to prove that in fact, yellow school buses are a way to go. So thank you.
Thank you. Tomke here, your fellow panelists have already thrown some challenges your way. So talk to us about public transit on the Cape.
Well, thank you, Heather. And I apologize that the sea line couldn't have gotten you here. The sea line actually does come right up here to this rotary and stops up there. So not too far away, but it's, you know, it's a bit challenging. The Cape is 400 square miles. We're responsible for providing public transportation to all 15 towns, which we now do. You know, prior to my coming here, We didn't have fixed route service in the Upper Cape from Bourne and Sandwich. We now go to all 15 Cape towns, and we have a mobility manager who monitors our routes all the time to encourage people to go to certain locations so we get more people onto public transportation. So it's a constant challenge, but a lot of great thoughts and ideas are coming forward. I read recently that 48% to 50% of all the greenhouse gas emissions can be attributed to the transportation sector. So that tells me, as a transportation leader, that we need to be aggressive in trying to deal with this. And I have to say, over the last year, Heather, last couple of years, with working closely with Jim Wolf and Dan Wolf and others, you know, the Cape Cod RTA, we've done a great deal to focus on renewable energy, energy efficiencies, and greenhouse gas emission reductions. If you've been over to our site, we're on 11 acres over there at in Hyannis, and we recently completed an 18-canopy solar project, which reduced our energy demand 93%. We've got 20 charging stations in place over there. It's really an extraordinarily beautiful job, and it was completed a couple of months ago. Secretary Paula came down, congratulated us as, you know, one of the RTAs that's forward-thinking when it comes to the importance of energy efficiencies. We also have an operations center down in Dennis where we keep our fleet, and we put panels on the entire roof of that facility. So that's all happened in the last year. We also have 30 shelters you might see across the Cape. Some of them are old wooden shelters, but we're exchanging them now for glass shelters with solar canopies to try to light and heat those as well. So we're making a considerable effort to adhere to the problems facing transportation today. We also introduced, many of you are probably familiar with, the Cape Flyer. We just completed our seventh year. We carried 16,000 people from down to the Cape on the 15 weekends in the summer, taking those vehicles off the road, and that's becoming increasingly popular. More great reviews about our performance with the Cape Flyer. And I'm now working with the town of Bourne to try to get the MBTA to extend from Middleborough to Buzzards Bay so that more folks can get onto public transportation. I was at the Transportation Bond hearing the other day with Wendy Northcross, and we were sitting listening to testimony, and there's no question, and we wholeheartedly support and endorse the goal of becoming completely electric when it comes to transportation vehicles. And I don't mean in the long term. We're aggressively trying to get there. But the reality is, you know, we have 400 square miles we're responsible for here at the Cape Cod RTA, and we're doing our due diligence to determine how to invest our limited resources when it comes to, you know, the length of how much charging the batteries would need, those kind of things, what the climate impacts are. There's a lot of good data that's coming forward, but we're looking at that every day, and hopefully in the not-too-distant future we will have a lot more electric. But the thing that I always remind people is, even though we have biodiesel and gasoline, if we get a lot of people onto public transportation, which we got 1.6 million last year, they're not in their cars. So that's helping a little bit. And I have a lot more to say, but I'm a former politician. You have to shut me up to answer any questions at the end. But there's a lot of other good stories that we have to tell you about on the Cape.
Hopefully we'll get to more of those. In the next, well, we've got 35 minutes now, to another former politician. And last but not least, Dan, air travel doesn't get a good rap when it comes to climate impacts.
Air travel gets no rap. I mean, the only way to get to an island is on a ferry.
So
and he was my formal colleague. Yeah.
So what
we're sponsoring this conference today, and there's no such thing as an airplane, but that's okay.
So talk to us about airplanes.
Yeah.
What role could or should, in your view of things, air travel play in specifically the Cape and Islands in a low-carbon, zero-carbon transportation system?
Thanks. I'm going to talk really fast. First, I want to thank Jamie Eldridge for being down here today. Good friend when I was in the Senate, and he actually overnighted at my house last night, which was really, it was generous of you to spend your time at our with our family. And I also want to say that Ed Markey has been an amazing friend, and I really look forward to hearing from Ed, and I'm really glad he's going to be here today, because we need to work with Ed going forward to make sure that a lot of his initiatives continue. They affect our industry, they affect all of the industries that are in the room, so I just want to say that at the beginning. Two things that we're doing as a company, and I think it's important. We're going to talk a little bit about the electric airplane, which is really exciting. But I think a lot of companies, what they're doing is looking at the carbon footprint and saying, how do we offset it? So, for example, at Cape Air, we're just starting our third significant solar project if the FAA gets out of the way and allows us to do it. So there's a public-private issue. We've done a lot of work with our employees. Our employees, we incentivize just about matching what the state was giving, except we're going to continue to give it to employees who want to participate by getting electric cars. So if you come and work for Cape Air, we'll help you buy that vehicle you're looking at. Putting in charging stations, all of the things, you know, giving efficient light bulbs to our employees and putting them in our hangars and installations. I know there are a lot of businesses on the Cape who are looking at doing that. And so that's a really important initiative, because to be able to measure, understand the carbon footprint, and then work actively to offset it. So it isn't just the mode of transportation and how do we do that in a carbon-free way, but how do we offset what we are doing? The really good news, and I will say, air transportation accounts for about 2.5% of climate-changing gases, of carbon gases in the atmosphere. So it's not like air travel is a huge amount, but it is 2.5%. We have been working with a company that was Israeli, although they're setting up their headquarters here in the United States, corporate headquarters in Seattle. They're going to be manufacturing the airplane in Arizona. And there it is. There's a picture of it. We were out there last week in Prescott, Arizona. That is an amazing piece of machinery. It's powered by three electric motors. We're already talking to Vineyard Wind, because we have to make sure that project gets done, about procuring the electricity for these airplanes from them. And you're looking at 3 or 4 years from now. Cape Air is the largest commuter airline in the United States, believe it or not. So we actually can show some leadership. We have 103 airplanes, and we would love over the next number of years to go completely electric with it. That is a complete state-of-the-art technology. And I have to say, if a proven technology like a wind turbine is so difficult to get approved by the federal government for installation, I worry about the certification challenges with a piece of technology like this. So I think it's really important for everybody in the room to understand what the public sector role is in this, and make sure we are forcing our government to be partners in making sure that these technologies that actually will reverse the trend come to market. I do want to give a couple of examples, not to be cynical, but when we were all engaged in the women's rights movement 50 years ago, women were earning 69 cents on a dollar. Here we are 50 years later, and women are earning 82 cents on a dollar. You could say the same thing about the civil rights movement and look at the wealth and income gap between whites and non-whites in this country. If we approach this topic with that same sense of urgency, we will fail. So I guess the question I would ask everybody in this room is, how do we actually approach what we need to get done, what we all agree on and know we need to do? How do we approach it differently from the movements that we have done over the last century, I would say, which have fallen way, way short? So there needs to be activism. There needs to be motive force. We need to get special interests that are blocking this out of the way. I know of what I speak because I was there for three terms, because it's not going to happen without an activist government. That sounds like an oxymoron. This isn't going to happen without an activist government that are partners with all of us, working with the private sector to get it done, air transportation in the middle of it. There's a lot of cool technologies emerging, and we at Cape Air are going to embrace every one of them, and we're going to be the leader. It is our goal to be the first airline in the United States to offer scheduled air service in an all-electric airplane, and I think we're 3 or 4 years off.
So, Dan, since you mentioned the women's rights and civil rights movements, I think it was the last of the goals that were listed in the introductory comments this morning to make sure that marginalized populations are addressed in some way. And I actually want to put that right at the top. I would love to just come down the table, and since you went last and you already mentioned social justice issues, where does thinking about equity and justice issues factor into the work that you're doing in the transportation sector in terms of climate impacts. Go ahead.
It's huge because, as was mentioned, a lot of if you look, for example, where Logan Airport is or where a lot of airports are, and the surrounding communities are very often underserved communities. Logan Airport is a great example. They have an all-electric initiative. All of their service vehicles at the airport have to be electric within a certain time frame. That's huge if you look at all the baggage cart service vehicles and everything. So a lot of our transportation nodes, even if you look where Tom's facility is in Hyannis, it's not a coincidence that a lot of the nodes of transportation where the negative impacts are exist in underserved communities. So I think it's important to understand that part of being in that community, being that node, we have a responsibility to those who are living in and around us. The other thing I'm a huge advocate for, and we're not doing it nearly enough yet, is subsidizing alternative modes of transportation for those who can't afford it. In the State House, it drove me crazy every time we looked at a fare increase at MBTA, putting more and more of the burden of paying for that system on the backs of those who need it because they can't afford automobile and other forms of mobility, and yet we're asking them to bear the burden of it. So I think we have to look at really subsidizing from the public sector alternate modes of transportation to those who otherwise would not be able to afford it. Mobility in general is a huge social justice issue, and I think we need to broaden that reality out and look at it as that.
Yeah, I think when you look at the More EV rebate program, one of the things we had a long discussion about was enabling low-income folks at a certain income level to get a larger EV rebate. And there were some real complications to that, you know, legally and Social Security numbers. So we've kind of avoided that. But what we did was 3 years ago, I piloted a program offered to two community action programs, one in Greenfield, one in Worcester. You can offer to your low income, anyone in your agency who meets the income levels, you can get $5,000 off a new or used battery electric vehicle. And in 2 years' time, we had one person take advantage of the rebate. So we kind of step back for a minute and took a look at that and said, well, that's not working. So let's look at doing a shared ride program in low-income communities. Now that the Eversource and National Grid are doing, they have to put in charging stations in environmental justice communities. You know, unfortunately, they went to Springfield and put those in a couple of hotels. Well, that's really not serving the environmental justice communities. So I said, how about we take a look at low-income agencies that are serving low-income population. We're readjusting the program to consider offering a free electric vehicle to an agency that's serving that low-income population and do it that way. So stay tuned to that one. We're working out the bugs, but we're hoping that we can provide agencies like Springfield Mental Health that every day their low-income staff go out and serve the mental health in their community, and in doing that in an electric car and getting Eversource to put in the charging station where it really counts would make a big difference. So we're working on that. So there is some movement there in the state because we want to see the low-income community be involved in electric vehicles. Unfortunately, out in California, they ran a program in some of the low-income communities, and there were no takers to use the ride. And it was a shared ride program where the car was available to low-income folks. They've had very little usage on the part of the low-income folks. So we probably won't go in that direction, but we're looking at that whole option.
At our organization, which is a nonprofit, Green Energy Consumers, whenever we touch an issue, we touch it with a program that consumers can tap into, as well, and then we advocate for better state and local policy. So we have a program called Drive Green. You can go to our website right now, and you can get a discount on a car. We focus on cars that the middle class can afford. I'm willing to bet you that my monthly payment on the Chevrolet Bolt that I drove here today is less than what most of you are paying for your cars. And so it's more accessible to the middle class than you think. Tesla's a wonderful car, but there are far more affordable electric vehicles than people think. And in about a week, we're going to roll out a program that offers used cars as an opportunity. You can go to our website and shop for a used car, because a lot of people have leased electric cars in the last couple of years, and when those cars come off the leases, they'll be more available in the market, and we think that's a good way for working-class folks to get an electric car. We also agree with the idea of we'd like to see electric cars in car sharing programs like Zipcar. It's a hard thing to pull off, but we generally support it. It's not going to be done at the margins. I would like to see the state get behind that in a big way.
Can I just jump in? Sorry, and interrupt. Why is it a hard thing to get those into the car sharing programs?
Zipcar, I think, is a wonderful model. It's a hard thing just to do Zipcar, which is, and I don't know how many facilities they have on Cape Cod, to be honest with you, but which is where they have to have parking spaces and where people subscribe to it, they can pick up the car. Electric cars work great, but when you try to put the two things together, which is having the ability of Zipcar to manage the charging stations and making sure that when the car comes back, it's got some juice in it so the next person can get into it, it's just multiplies the complexity. And so in fairness to Zipcar, I think they need more public support than that to do that. It's a nice way to accompany public transportation. The two go well together, which is if you have good access to public transportation but occasionally need a car, it's a nice marriage there. And so that's what we'd like to see. And again, we've talked about the localness of state government, of the Massachusetts. This is not kind of something that needs to be planned out a bit more at the state level, I think, to support cities and towns that want to do car sharing. And then next point I want to make is not everybody, as Steve just said, needs to own a car. That's why we're so focused on public transportation. The MBTA is a disgrace. It's been allowed to totally fall apart. And so we need to support the funding for that so we can get ridership and so people can get to work and whatnot without having to buy a car. There's a policy coming in place that I was going to speak to, the Transportation Climate Initiative. How many people have heard about that? Not enough, so that's why I'm here, I guess. So for the last several years, we've had a thing called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Essentially, it puts a little tax on fossil fuels that are used for electricity generation, and that has helped to reduce fossil fuel emissions. It's also created a big bag of money that goes into programs, primarily energy efficiency, that the Cape Light Compact has done some great things with to help subsidize the program that they run to help us all save energy. And so it ends up being a twofer. It reduces fossil fuel emissions and creates a lot of resources with which we can do something for. And that's a northeastern thing. It's not just Massachusetts. Well, now there's 12 states have just recently announced last week a framework where we're talking about doing something like that for on-road transportation fuels, gasoline and diesel. Essentially, within a couple of years, we're hoping to see that Massachusetts and other states will tax, I'm going to say that word, oil, diesel fuel, and gasoline. Should cover aviation fuel, I'll add, but it's not going to. And then that will create a big bag of money that can go towards public transportation and other things that can support the electrification of our economy.
Great.
So simply put, the groups that are marginalized are typically not at the table for these transportation planning discussions. So that's something we're trying to tackle head on at the commission. And so by way of a specific example, language is a big barrier to a number of folks. And particularly in our area, the Portuguese-speaking community is a group that's been typically underrepresented in the transportation planning process. So how can we build a system that works for everyone if we don't talk to everyone? So during the last regional transportation plan update, we attended the Revival Presbyterian Church of Cape Cod. They're located right next to the airport rotary, so they see firsthand some challenges out there on the transportation system. It was enlightening. It's a Portuguese-speaking service, so I struggled to understand all of it, but they were very gracious in letting us in and shared it with us, and we wanted to have a conversation with them. So it was informative to me to understand what their unique challenges are. I'll say they share many of the challenges that we do, is what they communicated. Two things that they keyed in on specifically were access to transit. One, they want to see more of the great CCRTA service, but it's clear that not everyone understood all the routes, so we're working with the RTA to make sure that sort of communication is out there so people can take advantage of the systems that are out there. Because certainly, whether it be for economic reasons or environmental reasons, getting folks on transit is a big goal. And secondly, they wanted to be able to safely walk in their communities. That seems like a basic right for folks to be able to get around in a safe manner, but that's something like they felt in many of their communities was not happening. So we want to make sure that when we're thinking about projects, we want to think about not just connecting some of the key resources for the visitors, for the residents, but for everyone who uses it. And that includes seasonal workers that come out here and often don't have a voice. So really, our approach to making sure that we deal with those groups that are traditionally marginalized is to engage with them and to understand what are their unique challenges. And certainly, they are very open to sharing their needs, and I think just being there, listening, and having that open line of communication is a big part of that. Because certainly it will take everyone to make a shift, and certainly we want to make sure we don't leave any groups behind as we journey forward.
Can we just clarify, in terms of feeling safe walking in your community, what are the safety concerns?
So specifically two concerns they identified. Many of the roads, the busier roads, they felt like they needed sidewalks. And that is something that for many roads is a clear need in this area, but something that we run up against a lot of NIMBYism. So certainly we recognize the unique character of this region. We're not saying we want to build sidewalks on every road, but there are roads, as you can see on this side, Route 28, which currently lacks sidewalks on 47% of the roadway. A sidewalk is needed there, simply put. So they want to see sidewalks on those high-speed roads. There are lower-speed roads that you can safely walk without a sidewalk. They felt unsafe because they were not well lit. So certainly thinking about that as well. These are infrastructure things that we can do now that will allow people to make a trip by foot rather than by car, or be able to, in an even better sense, walk to transit and take a longer trip. So those are the concerns we had. So they wanted to see sidewalks, and they wanted to see improved lighting.
Thank you.
Yeah, I wanted to recognize, you know, Christy and her staff over at the commission, because we work with Steve every other week. We go over there, or they come over to our place, and we talk about these matters. Just last week, we met with representatives from Walk Boston, and a few years ago, with commission's assistance, we did a very comprehensive review of all of our bus stops and access to bus stops, access to public transportation, and made the changes accordingly to make it safer and better. So we do have a great relationship with our planning agency. We're also developing right now, and we're going to unveil it by the end of this month, an app, an on-demand app, very similar to how Uber and Lyft run, that will allow us to get allow individuals to get closer to the fixed route service by just hitting an app. Presently, we have a general dial-a-ride service that you have to call in 24 hours before that to schedule your ride. Now you'll be able to have an app. We'll come get you, take you to where you need to go within certain zones on the Cape, but to all areas of where our fixed routes run to get people more onto public transportation. Again, I keep talking about, you know, our gas-run buses, but public transportation is critical, and I think what we can do in the short term is really do a very thorough, aggressive effort to get individuals onto public transportation. Steve mentioned the EJ communities. We looked at some of those environmental justice communities, all of the EJ communities across Cape Cod. We met with those individuals to try to locate our routes closer to those areas where we can make it easier for them to access public transportation. And the last thing I wanted to mention is Senate President Spilker asked me to sit on a Senate working group to develop policy for meaningful legislation within the next session. And I know that Senator Eldridge was here, but I don't know if he's still here, but Senator Bonacore and also several other senators are involved actively. And I'm on the sustainability subcommittee, and some of the efforts we're focusing in on are the environmental, obviously the electric vehicles, and mandating times when everyone would have to turn over to electrical vehicles, specific dates when that could occur, and obviously the zero-emission vehicle bills, and there's a number of them that were articulated earlier by Senator Sears. So I'm learning more about how we can make a difference at the state level and trying to implement them at the regional transit level. We have 15 regional transit authorities across the Commonwealth, and we have an association called MARTA, the Mass Association of Regional Transit Authorities. We meet regularly to share ideas, and we work with one another to make sure that some of the new technologies being developed are learned by everyone, all of my colleagues, and trying to implement some of those things as we move forward. So I think, you know, it seems as though things aren't moving as fast as we would all like, but I think Massachusetts is really you know, trying to move as expeditiously as possible on these matters. And as a transportation leader, I'm trying to do as much as I can. A member of my staff, Chris Kennedy over here, has attended all the 5C meetings, the ones that I can't get to or someone else can't get to. And the 5Cs Collaborative has really proposed some really good ideas to educate citizens all across the Cape about the important regional issues we need to be concerned about. You know, sea level rise and coastal erosion, that affects our bus routes as well. So the conversation that's taking place, which I guess is long overdue, is meaningful. And we're listening very closely and working closely with our great planning agency to try to make a difference and continue to make a difference. So just wanted to share those thoughts.
Tom, I want to stick with you because one thing you mentioned Cape Flyer very briefly, but one thing we haven't really hit on very much within the framework of overall multimodal low-carbon transportation for the Cape is rail. And I noted your part of your response to the Army Corps' recommendation for replacing the two bridges was, well, maybe we could enhance, and I'm using that word, enhance, maybe we could increase rail service between Buzzards Bay and Hyannis during those construction times, right, to take some of the load off of, you know, the fact that there aren't going to be bridges in service. In the longer term, not just during a construction phase, what realistically is the potential for expanding rail service to and around Cape Cod?
Yes, thank you, Heather. That's a good question. You know, I served 14 years in the legislature and all during those years and then became Deputy Secretary of Transportation for 10 years. So all those years I've been a supporter and a proponent of rail initiatives. And I always wanted the commuter rail to go to Buzzards Bay, but then Fall River, New Bedford got into the mix, and so it kind of delayed the effort to get to Buzzards Bay. But I always said to people when they said, why can't we have trains coming down to the Cape? I said, well, we invested when I was chairman of the Transportation Committee in the House. We did invest greatly in restoring all the old colony lines that go from Greenbush, Scituate, Plymouth, Kingston, Middleborough, Lakeville. And I always said, well, we'll never have rail on the Cape for a number of reasons. The infrastructure is restricted speeds. It's used for freight. It would cost an inordinate amount of money to invest in making that all happen. But ironically, I had a conversation with Secretary Pollack at my office a couple of weeks ago about, and she's been very focused working with Wendy on the bridge issue, about those kind of things. When bridge construction takes place, we have monumental traffic hazards now whenever there's any maintenance. So when these bridges are being constructed, and it's not too distant future, we need to think about ways to get people on and off the Cape in a much more efficient and safe manner. So I suggested just off the top of my head that maybe we should find some place in the mid-Cape where we could develop some parking facilities and get people onto rail and then over to Buzzards Bay and up to South Station. But it's just a thought. But I think we have to be thinking along those lines of multimodal collaboration so that we can, you know, as I say, it's the last time I'll say it, I'm 100% and fully supportive of getting a full electrically vehicle fleet, maybe before, I know I'm young, but before I leave. But the more people we get out of their cars makes a difference. And we have a multimodal committee that meets with the various modes, and Dan has participated. When, you know, he's so busy when he was in the Senate, but they're always represented. Katie's always represented. We talk about how we can work to collaborate and make a difference and get more people off our roads that were never built to accommodate the volumes they have to deal with now on the Cape. So we're looking at multimodal initiatives to try to resolve some of these matters.
Steve Topper, you've touched on pedestrian access on roads and safety. What about bikes? I mean, and this connects to the rail issue, right? A lot of our rail lines are no longer rail lines. They're bike and pedestrian paths, but they're more geared at recreational. Let's go for a nice bike ride on Sunday afternoon, not necessarily let's get to work, let's get to the store. What about bike infrastructure for the Cape?
Absolutely. Great question. So in our perspective, bicycling is a mode of transportation. So certainly we are most well known for our paths that have a real recreational feel, and that's certainly a regional draw, but it also is a transportation asset. So we've been slowly, I'd like to see it much more quickly, building a regional spine of bike facilities going from Woods Hole up to Bourne all the way out to Provincetown. And those have been very well received within the communities. They are used by recreational cyclists as well as people trying to get to destinations. But that's not enough. So really the next step is trying to connect up to destinations. So I talked with a woman this morning about how nice it was that she lived off of the rail trail. She could hop right on and take a ride, but she felt unsafe getting to our destinations on some of the local roadways. So really ramping up that activity, making people recognize that bicycling is a mode of transportation, and if you provide those connections that people feel safe using, they will use them for transportation purposes. So certainly encouraging folks that are a little bit hesitant, but also recognizing there are a lot of people out there cycling on roads today that are not safe. So certainly that's a particular issue in the summer with the summer workforce, maybe less familiar with the safety, with the rules of the road out here. And we don't provide them adequate facilities, simply put. A lot of folks are riding up and down Route 28 because they don't have an option. That's the road they use. So we need to do a better job thinking about improvements along Route 28 and other key corridors. That is an area that we are making some progress on. So currently under construction or within the next 5 years, there's 10 major reconstruction projects on Route 28. They will all be including bicycle and pedestrian upgrades for those locations. So I would like to say it's going to happen quickly, but really this is an effort that happens piece by piece. So when we talk about bicycling, it's really about identifying those key gaps and trying to fill those key gaps so that people can use a bicycle as a mode of transportation, not just for a Saturday ride, which many folks will still enjoy, is still great, but we really have to think about it as a mode of transportation as well. And then certainly, as with the pedestrian, you can ride your bike to a bus stop, put your bike right on the bike rack on the front of the CCRTA buses, and make a real transportation journey that way. So those linked trips are really the way that a network should work, and that's where we have to get as a region.
I just wanted to also mention, when we developed the Cape Flyer, we created a uniqueness about the train where we have a bike car, where we have 65 bike stands in one car with tools for people to work on their bikes as they come to the Cape. And my plan was to have a stop on the south side of the canal, which we finally did this year, which made a huge difference. And the idea behind that was for people to get off with their bikes there. We're working with the town of Bourne to connect the Shining Sea, the very popular Shining Sea bike path in Falmouth, to the canal. And that's ongoing with great support from the community. Town meeting supported, appropriated some funds. So there will be connectivity from Woods Hole all the way to Provincetown. And that's all part of the thought process of getting bike and ped activity here on the Cape more vibrant.
So we've got about 10 minutes, maybe a little bit less. I want to make sure we respect that and give Senator Markey his full time. So I want to ask each of you for some final thoughts and maybe within the framework of whether, and I think this is a larger question for climate change, but specifically within the transportation realm. Is it enough to be thinking about different fuel sources, right? That we still have cars, they're just electric. We still have buses, they're just electric. We still have airplanes, they're just electric. We still have ferries, they're just electric. Or do we need to be more fundamentally rethinking what transportation means in our lives, how mobile we are, and rethinking this at a deeper level?
I think that's a great question. You know, we were at the hearing the other day, and there was some very good dialogue between the committee members and the governor and the secretary. And you know, the technology advancements that I've witnessed just in this industry over the last 10, 20 years have been so immense that we're changing constantly the way we provide public transportation. So, you know, electric vehicles is clearly a priority and an important priority to deal with the effects of climate change. But I think everything is on the table, and those ideas and thoughts and people that have some expertise in those areas need to continue to have that conversation, because you know, the technology is amazing. The things we can do now that we never could have dreamed of, you know, 15, 20 years ago by just talking to your phone and apps that get your bus in 2 seconds. So I think it's a great question, and I think it's something that warrants further investigation.
And from my perspective, the electrification of the transportation system isn't happening fast enough for us to put all our eggs in that basket. So I think we have to explore all of the options in terms of reducing emissions. So there's some simple things you can do on the local level that really can make a small difference but contribute to a big change. So I'll give you two specific examples on that front. So the reason, the overwhelming reason that our transportation system doesn't work well is because of land use. It is a spread out region. We don't have enough concentrated nodes of activity. So it makes transit hard, it makes pedestrian access hard, it makes bicycling hard. So when there's a town meeting discussion, when there's a board of selectmen discussion about zoning changes, that's important. That changes the way our communities are built. So you have to get behind those and think of that as a way to attack GHGs. Similarly, when there's discussion, and I'm going to use this word that I know has a different connotation in many realms, complete streets. Complete streets does not mean you need to build this bike lane and a sidewalk everywhere. It means you think about everyone when you're building or redoing a street. So get behind those efforts as a way to reduce GHGs. So those are things that can be done at the local level that can be done now while we electrify the transportation system, because that's not enough to just wait for that.
I think it's both. I don't think the statistic has come out yet today, but when you switch from gasoline or diesel to an electric car, and you're on your basic utilities service, the basic one offered by the Cape Light Compact. I live in Quincy with National Grid. You're going to reduce your emissions by 75% to 80%, and that's going to go down every year because of the state's renewable portfolio standard. And so that's rough. That's the trajectory that we need in order to meet our climate goals. A saying I have is you can't get to Paris in a Prius. And so I don't want to hear about how efficient your gasoline-powered car is. We need to go to electrification. So that's part of the answer. But the other answer is simple. It's just a crying shame that public transportation ridership all across the country, all across Massachusetts, and I don't know about the Cape, but certainly in the MBTA ridership has fallen. And that's because of a lack of public commitment. And so we need both in order to reduce the emissions in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. I oftentimes meet with fleets and look at, you know, diesel trucks, pickup trucks. You know, there's 40 million pickup trucks on the road today, and so something has to be done about that piece of transportation that won't be electrified for a while. And so I advocate for propane, LPG. You can use that in pickup trucks. You can use that in vans. You can use that in other equipment, lawn mowing equipment. The big gang mowers can be used with propane. So that's one way to reduce emissions. Natural gas. I know there's a constraint on the Cape for natural gas, but if you would request that your community take a look at the refuge trucks, which is a great place to eliminate diesel and go with natural gas, CNG is a way to go. So there's also hybridizing pickup trucks. There's a company here in Massachusetts called XL Hybrid. They can take and they add hybridization, saves 20% to 30% in fuel in the usage of those pickup trucks and vans with a drive shaft. So there's a lot of other things. And I applaud the Transit Authority for using biodiesel, B20 biodiesel. You have right here on the Cape a company called Cape Cod Biodiesel. They collect from, I believe, about 700 restaurants on the Cape their waste grease, and they turn it into a usable fuel. So tell your town to start using biodiesel in their diesel trucks. It's much better for the environment and reduces the amount of petroleum by over 20%. So there are other things we can do besides electrification. I came here, I've been driving electric for 6 years, and I have some great stories to say about it. Yesterday I decided to come in last night early, avoid the storm and the 2.5-hour ride from Boston. And I got here and I went to Cape Cod Mall to charge up my car. And guess what? The charging station has been sequestered in their construction site. So I panicked. It was like, oh no. So Whole Foods. I drove over to Whole Foods and they have a fast charging station. So I sat there for an hour and a half, had dinner in my car and charged up, but it took care of me. So there are ways to really. So anybody here in the room drive electric? Excellent. So take a hard look at the next time you go to buy a vehicle and consider electric. It's not as crazy as you think. You can charge at home. You can charge at your neighbor's 110 outlet. So there's ways to go without you know, really without worrying about getting that electricity. And guess what? The cost of maintenance on your electric vehicle goes away. There's no oil changes and no transmission. You know, it's no exhaust system. You know, for those people who do short trips, how many times do you replace your exhaust system in your car? Probably once a year. All goes away. So I think it's a really take a serious look at electrifying your own transportation because emissions is important. Thank you.
And thanks to my much better looking brother, Jim, you can come get charged at Cape Air. Right?
That's right.
I would say a couple of things. From a zoning and planning standpoint, we need to look at ways to reduce, and I think, Heather, you were getting at this. Do we need the are we using mobility in a smart way? It's crazy to get in the car to walk a dog. We should be looking to create density in our communities where people can be social and walk and active. We should be promoting sidewalks and bike paths and all of that. So that's part of it. The other thing I would say is that we need to look at supply chain, and we need to be careful how we do this, because it's really important where the electricity comes from and that that's sustainable. It's really important how the batteries are manufactured and produced, where the resources are for that, how we dispose of them. And so the whole supply side chain as we electrify, we need to make sure we're not just creating the next generation's problem as we do it. And I just want to, the generational warfare thing is bugging me. I guess that's because I'm 62 now. I think the younger people, and we need to say this, need to understand that when this problem was created, we didn't have the consciousness and understanding. And we also need to remind them that the technologies that exist to actually address this also came from our generation. The electric technologies, the scientific research and understanding and studies, we're also giving that to the next generation. So we're not only giving them the problem, but I think we're giving them the solution. So lecture back the next time you get old folked and guilt-tripped, okay? That's just my pledge to that. Because I hate for those of us over 50 to leave these meetings feeling browbeaten like we screwed future generations. We've given them incredible opportunity and capacity. And let's ask them to fix it instead of feeling guilty about what we've done to them.
Okay.
I say that as a new grandfather.
With 30 seconds here, a little unfair perhaps since we don't have anyone from the Steamship Authority here, but Dan, you had a challenge that I want to put on the record. Your challenge for the Steamship Authority between you and Cape Air and the Steamship Authority.
Yeah, I would like to see all electric boats going to the islands before we have our all electric airplanes. If you think of the physics of it, it should be easier. Boats need ballast and they like to be heavy. Airplanes need to be light. You would think it would be harder to put an airplane into the all electric universe faster than a boat. So I know the technologies are there. The challenge is let's not just have it be airplanes versus ferries. Let's have it be across the board. Which mode of transportation, not bicycles, that doesn't count, which mode of transportation will electrify first? And let's have it be a race. And I just say in closing, Heather, I love it when John F. Kennedy put on the table putting a person on the moon and how quickly we did that. When we needed to, we converted a peacetime manufacturing base to wartime to fight World War II. Unfortunately, we never converted it back, but that's a different issue. If we have the motive force and force our public officials and force our democracy to do it, can do this a lot quicker than anyone can imagine. And that should be the challenge. We cannot wait 50 years for this. So let's just challenge all of us. It's a race to the moon.
All right.
A big battery. That would take a big battery.
Big battery.